the various Indian tribes of the region during this period experienced an awakening of nativistic spirit accompanied by millennial religious messages promising a new golden age. This awakening gave Indians a sense of racial solidarity they had not had before. The overtly anti-white and particularly anti-American attitudes produced by this awakening provided the ideological foundation for a variety of Indian resistance movements, culminating in those led by the Shawnee chief Tecumseh and his brother Tenskwatawa, or the Shawnee Prophet. The brothers united the disparate tribes of the Trans-Appalachian West into a confederation that forcibly resisted the United States and attempted to turn back the tide of white settlement. While the defeat of Tecumseh's confederation during the War of 1812 greatly diminished this ideology of resistance, it did not destroy it. Indeed, the Black Hawk War was proof of its continued existence almost 20 years later.
During 4 months in 1832, the Black Hawk War became a major force in defining Wisconsin and Illinois as we know them today. We have a good idea of how that war went from the American side, but what was the Indian experience like? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
In the 1830s, while Americans were doing their best to push eastern tribes west of the Mississippi, did the Native Americans start to see themselves as one group of people? Was Black Hawk a more capable general than his American counterparts, but just overwhelmed by numbers and technology? To what extent were the Indians responsible for the Black Hawk War? And to what extent did Black Hawk himself blame his fellow Indians for the outcome of that war? Our guest is Patrick Young, professor of history at the Milwaukee School of Engineering and the author of various articles on military and American Indian history. His book, The Black Hawk War of 1832, was published by the University of Oklahoma Press in 2007.
Well, welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
I know sometimes I'm asked about my Jane Austen book, why another book about Jane Austen? And you raised that question in your introduction about your book, why another book about this war of 1832, the Black Hawk War?
Well, the book itself came out of my dissertation, which I did at Marquette University. And in the course of researching my dissertation, I was struck by a major shift in the thinking of American Indians, particularly those who were between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River. It began in the 1740s, and I owe a great deal of debt to a scholar at Notre Dame named Gregory Dowd, who had done the initial work on what he called a nativistic revival of Indian racial ideology. And as I increasingly was doing my dissertation research, I saw how influential this idea was, how Indians had this new sense of racial solidarity they hadn't had before. And I was able to sort of trace that directly to what the first major uprising after the War of 1812, which was the 1827 Winnebago Uprising, and directly into the Black Hawk War of 1832.
And Black Hawk himself was a subscriber to this early on, or at what point did he start looking at Indian solidarity as a way of resisting?
I think he was probably a little bit skeptical of it. During the War of 1812, he fought on the side of the British, as did virtually all Indian tribes in what is today the Midwest. But he wasn't a particularly strong adherent of Tecumseh and the Shawnee Prophet. They were the real heart and soul of this new sense of racial ideology. But nevertheless, I think he absorbed a lot of the rhetoric. He absorbed a lot of the ideology. And certainly the Indians who sided with him, the Sauk and the Foxes and the Winnebagoes, they certainly were adherents of this sort of pan-Indian identity as well.
Where was Black Hawk and his tribe when Tecumseh was out rounding up enthusiasm for this sense of pan-Indian identity?
Black Hawk was a Sauk, and one of their main villages was Sauconook, which would today be Moline, Illinois, the Quad Cities area. And the Sauks lived primarily in the Mississippi River Valley in Illinois. They had several village sites there, also in the West Bank in Iowa. They were also confederated with another tribe known as the Foxes, more traditionally nowadays called the Meskwaki. And they lived farther to the north, and they had village sites along the Mississippi all the way into Wisconsin and I think even Minnesota. So they were located in the upper Mississippi River Valley, and they were close enough to the proximity of where Tecumseh and the Shawnee Prophet were spreading their message. And in fact, there were Indian tribes as far away as Lake Superior who were sending emissaries down to Indiana so they could learn more about the Shawnee Prophet's teachings and about the Indian Confederacy of Tecumseh.
And how did communication take place? I mean, I would assume you're talking about multiple languages. And if you're trying to promote pan-Indian thinking as a way of resisting white oppression, if you're trying to create a unity that wasn't there before, how is this taking place?
Well, first of all, many of the Indian languages were pretty closely related. For example, the Meskwaki language or the Fox language and Sauk are identical. And they speak the exact same language as the Kickapoo. There was sort of a lingua franca in the Midwest that was Ojibwa. So there were always people who could speak Ojibwa, and Ojibwa was sort of the common language. I'm not sure if the Shawnee Prophet or Tecumseh spoke them, but certainly there were enough speakers of Ojibwa. And again, Shawnee is not that distantly related. So they could speak in very related languages, and they had a common Algonquian tongue of Ojibwa. Even among the Winnebago. Now, Winnebago, or the Ho-Chunk as they're called here in Wisconsin, their language is about as close to Ojibwa or Sauk and Fox as English is to Chinese. But even there, they had a lot of Ojibwa speakers who could, you know, translate things.
And as you were looking into previous accounts of the Black Hawk War, I guess the question I was getting at initially is, what did you see as wrong or missing or lacking in accounts?
The most important thing, again, was the fact that, you know, Gregory Dowd at Notre Dame had written several articles and a book called A Spirited Resistance. And that really kind of transformed my thinking. I think a lot of people tend to think of American Indians, especially prior to reservations and everything, as sort of living in this timeless, changeless, you know, society. And they had shifts in thinking. They had shifts in ideology and racial ideas as much as any other group of people did. And I think he did the most to really clarify that and to enunciate it. And so I thought that was missing. And a lot of this new racial identity and racial solidarity was expressed as resistance to removal by the United States. And it had certain racial elements in it, anti-white attitudes, particularly anti-American attitudes. And because, you know, his work had only been recently published, I mean, nobody else had integrated that type of scholarship into any new works. So I figured that was missing. The other thing was the fact that in the 1970s, there was a scholar named Ellen Whitney in Illinois, who she worked for the Illinois State Historical Library. And she edited all the major papers of the Black Hawk War, all the unit rosters, all the letters, diaries, etc. And it was just a monumental work. She clarified a lot of things that were mistakes, factual errors. And only a few scholars had really dipped into that. One of the reasons I think there's probably going to be more scholarship on the Black Hawk War is because of her arduous work over a decade of, you know, looking at all the different papers, checking for errors, checking for mistakes. And so that was another reason. That was just a wealth of information. And so I really kind of rode on the shoulders of previous scholars. So I felt this is a good time. And I discovered a few new things myself that I thought would be good to put in there.
Well, if we go back to Black Hawk and his tribe there on the eastern banks of the Mississippi, Moline, Illinois, the Quad Cities area. And in those years, let's say 1812 to 1832 or so, it was a time when there was an awful lot of pressure coming up from Kentucky, white settlement into Kentucky, pushing then across the Ohio River into Ohio and displacing a lot of those tribes from Kentucky and Ohio. Was Black Hawk already starting to feel that pressure, the incursion of other tribes displaced by it?
I don't think he was necessarily. And it's important to understand that Black Hawk, I don't think necessarily was the person who enunciated a lot of the doctrines and dogmas that would be important to his own movement of trying to resist American removal. A lot of that, his followers had latched onto that. In the 1790s, the United States had a couple major campaigns against Indians in Ohio. And already there was a confederation formed there, a pan-Indian confederation in the 1790s. Black Hawk himself, I think he was relatively young when that happened. But there were even Sox who fought in the Ohio Indian Confederacy in the 1790s. So I think there were already members of his own tribe who, as early as the 1790s, said, we have to go east and help our brethren like the Shawnee and the Miami in Ohio so that we can, you know, resist the problem of American removal later on. So he was certainly aware of that happening. So the Sox themselves had had a pretty long history before 1832 of, you know, trying to aid and abet other tribes in resisting American removal.
He dealt with white people directly up until 1832?
Oh, yeah. He had had a lot of contact when he was a young man. There were Spanish soldiers at St. Louis because the Louisiana Territory was then part of Spain. He had, you know, met with Spanish military officers. When the United States took formal control of Louisiana in 1804, he had contact with Indian agents and military officers at St. Louis. So he was very much in contact. And during the War of 1812, he was recruited by the British, so he fought with the British, and he fought in Ohio. So if you just think about, you know, how big his world was, he lives in what is today Moline, Illinois, but he had certainly traveled as far south as St. Louis. He had traveled as far east as Ohio, and the Sox and the Foxes were known to go buffalo hunting out as far as what is today Kansas. Mm. So they had a pretty good geographical knowledge of a pretty big area.
You end your book with a sort of tribute, I guess, to Black Hawk's heroism, mm-hmm. sort of the contributions he made despite his humiliation at the end and so on. And I'm just curious, when you looked into all the documents pertaining to Black Hawk, you know, by and about him, what sense did you have of him as a heroic figure even before the Black Hawk War occurred?
Well, the one thing that's unique about Black Hawk is he had an autobiography published. The year after the war, there was an Illinois newspaper editor. There was a lot of hoopla about Black Hawk mm-hmm. after the war, obviously. And people wanted to get books out right away and sort of capitalize on that. There was a newspaper editor in Illinois who worked with an interpreter to basically have Black Hawk recount his life. And it was really the first Indian autobiography ever written. And you can check it against white sources, and it's pretty accurate. So you already have a good feel for who he was from that autobiography. He was a traditional Sauk warrior, and among Indian tribes of the Great Lakes region in the Midwest, all men were warriors, and that's how you had your reputation. And he wasn't born a chief. He wasn't born into a chiefly clan. So what leadership he had was based on his own personal charisma, his own outstanding record as a warrior. And that was his path to success. So he was one of the most well-known warriors of his generation among the Sox. So he was really brave to a fault. Like most Indian warriors, he really didn't fear death. As a matter of fact, they believe that you can, you know, die a glorious death in battle, but you can only really humiliate by surrendering and sparing your life. And he ascribed to that. But he was, I think, especially at the Battle of Wisconsin Heights, he really was at his best. He held back a force probably six times the size of his own, long enough for his women and children to cross the Wisconsin River. And he fully expected after the war, when he was captured, that he would be put to death. And he was pretty stoic about it. It turned out he was very humiliated by the fact they kept him in jail and they kept him alive. And he found that much
more. Wearing a ball and chain.
Yeah, wearing a ball and chain. He was much humiliated by that. But I really came out respecting his courage and his leadership. Where his biggest fault, though, is he wasn't very worldly or cosmopolitan. Tecumseh knew a lot about the white man's world. He knew a lot about Americans and everything else. Black Hawk didn't really know that much about the white man's world. The year after the war, he's taken to Washington to meet Andrew Jackson. He has no idea how big the United States is. He can't imagine a city the size of Philadelphia or New York, and he's stunned by it. And I think had he known that, and of course one of the reasons they took him east was so that he could see that for himself, and he would say, wow, I shouldn't have done this. I think had he known, had he been as worldly as Tecumseh, and I think as cosmopolitan, he probably would have thought twice before trying to resist the removal. But the fact is, I have a lot of respect for who he was and what he did.
Now, despite these sentiments of pan-Indian unity resisting the white incursions, there was also a long tradition still continuing in the 1830s of Indians fighting Indians. What was the nature of warfare between Indian tribes? What were the rules and how did it work out?
I was kind of struck by the anomaly that from the 1740s onward, Indians developed a stronger sense of racial consciousness. And Tecumseh in particular said, we have to put aside tribal differences and we've got to unite if we're going to have any hope of resisting removal by the whites. And that struck a nerve. I think as long as Indians thought there was a real chance of being able to resist white removal, they would stick together. But after the War of 1812, they had no longer had British support. It looked like that whole effort was doomed. And the idea of putting aside tribal differences sort of fell by the wayside. The idea of uniting to resist American removal wasn't gone, but it was sort of a shadow of what it had been. And again, the fact that sort of illustrates that is, you know, Black Hawk only led 1/6 of the Sauk and Fox tribes. His rival Keokuk led the vast majority.
But when the Indians actually fought each other, did they behave any differently than when they fought whites?
No, not for the most part. Most tribes, they understood that if they killed an Indian, the worst thing that was going to happen is their tribal enemies would try to exact revenge. The chiefs generally tried to dissuade them from attacking white settlers and Americans because they knew that ultimately the United States would hold the tribes accountable, that they had to hand over the murderers and the murderers would be found guilty and hanged. That was a well-known fact. So the rules were different. They were much more willing to fight Indian enemies because they weren't going to be held accountable by the United States for the most part. But they pretty much fought the same. Warfare was an individual act. It wasn't so much like we see war as, you know, disciplined units that, you know, function as a machine. It was individual warriors going up against other individual warriors and trying to display bravery in battle.
Did they attack villages? Did they kill women and children? And was scalping of the Indian tradition?
Yeah, they did not differentiate between combatants and non-combatants. Women and children generally were as legitimate a target as any warrior was. Although I think even by the 1830s, there were some Indians who were beginning to – Black Hawk was one. He asserted he had never killed a woman or a child, only another warrior. But generally that was, I think, a later development. So they would attack villages, depending how big the war party was, obviously. Generally there were small war parties that would look for sort of, you know, hunters or warriors who were out of their enemy, who were out in small hunting parties or something. And yes, they did scalp. One of the things I want to research in the future, in the 1600s, in the probably early 1700s, what they usually did when they captured another warrior, if they didn't kill him right away, was they had these very stringent tortures that they put their enemies through. And the Iroquois in particular, if you ever read a description of an Iroquois torture ceremony, it'd make your skin crawl. But by the time you get to Black Hawk's day, torturing enemies was no longer done. Generally, it was they would just kill them, scalp them, and oftentimes desecrate the corpse.
The scalping is sometimes credited to the British invention, but
that
predate
them? That is something that is still being heavily debated by scholars, that the British paid Indians for scalps, and the British did. But at this point, the jury is, I think, still out on whether scalping was, you know, a British invention or an Indian invention. It's still one of those things that I think you can find people in both camps. I personally tend to think that scalping predated the British. Again, this for some reason that one reasons I can't fully figure out yet. They went from torturing victims in, you know, very violent ways and things that would again just make your skin crawl. And they switched to just killing, scalping, and desecrating corpses.
And if Black Hawk, as you mentioned, who was not born into a chief clan, establishes reputation by proving himself to be a great warrior, was that as a warrior against other Indians? And if so, what was it? Was it his physical strength, his, you know, what made him a great warrior?
Well, I think he was relatively just brave to a fault. I mean, he really absorbed the entire ethos that Indian warriors were supposed to possess. And he had had a lot of success in battle, too. He had to kill someone to become a full warrior, to be able to wear war paint, to be able to lead a war party on your own. And I think he became a full-fledged warrior when he killed an Osage Indian. He was 12 years old. And he took the scalp just like he was supposed to. He recounts it in great detail how proud his father was of him. Initially, the Sauks were fighting with the Osage Indians of Missouri. They were fighting for a lot of the same hunting grounds. During the War of 1812, he sided with the British and participated in the siege of several, I think it was Fort Meigs in Ohio. And so he had made a reputation for himself fighting on the side of the British during the War of 1812. So he had just had a long, successful career of killing other Indians, killing white soldiers, and that's how he made his reputation.
We're going to follow the Black Hawk War, or was it really a massacre, not a war, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Gunter von Hagen's Body Worlds 1, the original exhibition of real human bodies, now an exhibit for a limited engagement at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Presented by Northwestern Mutual Foundation. Tickets at mpm.edu.
In the year 28, Saxon foxes were told that according to the treaty, their lands would be sold, and they must remove to the Iowa ground, where good village sites could readily be found. But Black Hawk protested his love was so strong. For his village, moreover, he thought it was wrong, for white men to take land, and he would not admit that the treaty was valid by which they claimed it. Amermill's Stocking.
1926 or so, a look
yes.
at the Black Hawk War, which is what we're doing with our guest Patrick Young. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and we've looked at the picture leading up to what became known as the Black Hawk War in 1832. A lot of sporadic, small-scale fighting leading up to this, but what actually sparked what we would call this war or massacre, as some would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it is safe to say, and this is one of the things I wanted to really assert when I wrote my book, was that Black Hawk really didn't have an intention of fighting when he crossed the Mississippi in April of 1832. It's a little bit hard to discern exactly what he wanted, but I think if you look at sources enough and you read his autobiography enough, you can understand that what he wanted to do was cross back across the Mississippi. He had promised he wouldn't occupy his village site anymore, so he took the safe course of moving up the Mississippi to where the Winnebago Prophet lived, who was an ally of his. And he lived on unceded or unsold Indian land. And what Black Hawk wanted to do was unite all the tribes of northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin, produce a show of force that would be, in his eyes, pretty impressive. And the United States, fearing a general Indian war, would instead renegotiate the treaty, which his people had signed in 1804, selling their land in western Illinois.
So he was actually, Black Hawk and the tribe had actually spent, a winter or more on the Iowa side of the Mississippi, and now they were coming back.
Right. They had – actually, most of the tribe was in Iowa by that time, and it was only the stalwarts under Black Hawk's leadership who wanted to stay on the east side of the Mississippi. And they had made a stand in 1831, but the United States made it very clear that if they didn't remove, they were going to attack the village of Sauconook, and they would not spare anyone. And ultimately, just because he had women and children and old tribal members living with him – he very, I think, rightly decided to remove under cover of night so that his people wouldn't be attacked. And he had to sign an agreement with the United States in 1831 saying he wouldn't reoccupy his village site anymore. So he sort of figured out a loophole saying, well, if I move up beyond my village site to where the Winnebago Prophet lives and get this big Indian confederacy like Tecumseh did or like the Ohio Indians did, I can, you know, tell the United States I want to renegotiate our treaty.
The little poem that you started with and that you use as epigraphs, it sounds so pat, you know, kind of it's got that 'twas the night before Christmas, you know, doggerel sound. And it's – but it does hint at the fact that he took a stand over the land. And I'm just mm-hmm. curious, with the removal from the land they had, how heartbreaking was that? How important was the actual land that they were forced to leave? Because, you know, we hear about him moving and trying to establish a new place, but just curious how hard it was for him to leave that place.
Well, he really wanted to stay there, and he had the one thing he goes into in his autobiography is he said he wanted his bones to lie beside those of his fathers and grandfathers. Now, Sauconook itself had, by his time, probably been occupied for probably a little bit less than a century. So it wasn't as though they had lived there for centuries and millennia or anything like that. But I think he also just felt that the treaty by which the land was ceded was not negotiated in good faith. And I think that was a strong principle not only with him but with his followers. The 1804 treaty was negotiated by William Henry Harrison, who would later go on to become president of the United States for a month before he died in office. He basically got – there was a small delegation of Sox and Foxes who had come to see him about something else. From what we know, because there was no journal kept, which was itself not a standard American practice, he got the signatories drunk, told them that they were selling a small amount of land in Missouri. And when they woke up with hangovers the next morning, they found out they had ceded all of western Illinois and a little bit of land in Missouri as well. And he felt that they weren't sent there for that. I mean, the people who the Sox and Foxes sent didn't have the authority to sell the land. But once a treaty was made, the U.S. didn't care how, you know, didn't care who signed it, whether it was people who were authorized or not. They said, we're going to make you stick by it. So I think that was a big part of it too. He just didn't see that the 1804 treaty as having any real legitimacy.
So he was coming back with a relatively small number of people to the village site of Saucanuck, which was more or less abandoned by this point?
Well, yeah. In 1832, it had not only been abandoned by the Indians, which was probably, again, a smart idea by Black Hawk, but white squatters had already moved in and taken over the best cornfields and even some of the Indian habitations.
And where do the sparks start to fly?
Well, where they start to fly is when he goes up to the Winnebago Prophet's village, as he said he was going to do. At that point, the United States, ironically, really wasn't that concerned because they were far more concerned about an Indian massacre that had happened the summer before up at Prairie du Chien, where a group of Sox had massacred, I think, upwards of 30 Menominee Indians. So they were in the Menominees were rightly angered by the act. So anyway, Black Hawk was sort of a distraction at first, and then he makes it clear, even after he's ordered to go back west, he refuses. And then he moves up farther to about where Rockford, Illinois is today, tries to get the Potawatomis and the Winnebagos to side with him. And he realizes that he's kind of in an uphill struggle here. He only had about 1,000 people. There were also some Kickapoos who were also under pressure to remove. He had gotten a few Potawatomis and a few Winnebagos to side with him. But for the most part, the Potawatomis and the Winnebagos of Illinois and Wisconsin said, look, this isn't going to work. We are not going to ally with you because it's just too great of a risk. So he begins to start to see that, hey, this might not work. My plan might kind of go, you know, be a wash. But by that time, the United States had already formed a militia army, and a group of Illinois militia kind of ran into a group of Black Hawk's warriors around what is today Stillman's Valley, Illinois, and that precipitated the Battle of Stillman's Run. And it was only about 40 Indian warriors under Black Hawk's leadership, and they defeated a force of like 200 Illinois militia.
How?
Well, because these Illinois militia, first of all, most of them were drunk. Okay, that's not a good way to fight in a war.
A big thread through American history.
And plus, I mean, unlike Indian warriors, again, they were up against warriors who had been in battle before. They understood that when it starts getting in the thick of the fight, you don't panic and run because that's going to spell disaster. These were untrained militiamen. They were drunk. They had never been – most of them, I doubt any of them had ever really been in battle before. And the Black Hawk's 40 warriors showed very good discipline. They advanced in ranks, shot at the Illinois militia. Illinois militia panicked and ran. Only 12 of them were killed at Stillman, well, the Battle of Stillman's Run, as it was called. But they were thoroughly humiliated. But once blood was shed, because I think Black Hawk lost 3 warriors and the Illinois militia had lost 12. Once blood starts to flow, and I think this is a truism in any war, it gets very difficult to find diplomatic solutions or compromises.
Right.
Everybody wants revenge.
And what kind of weapons, what kind of technology?
The Indians had the same technology as the white militia for the most part. They were using – I would imagine they were – at that time, still using flintlocks. They had firearms, though. They had gunpowder. They had firearms. They had ammunition, which they got from white traders. So they were evenly matched. The Illinois militia had just, you know, muskets as well. They might have had one or two small artillery pieces, but I doubt anything.
Wouldn't have been of great value against
Indians. I think when I was doing my research, I think Henry Atkinson, who was a brigadier general in the U.S. Army, I think he had one field artillery piece 6-pounder, which was not real big during the entire battle. So it was fought just with typical muskets of the day. But the Indians had them, the whites had them. So they were evenly matched as far as that goes.
At what point do civilians get pulled into the conflict?
Right away. And the reason, quite simply, is the U.S. Army was hardly a crack force in the 1830s. The total size of the army was like about 6,000 people. That, I mean, it was roughly equivalent to 2 modern combat brigades in the U.S. Army. You know, that's minuscule. You know, 6,000 men is just not that – and they had a whole lot of area to protect. Plus, there was no cavalry. And Indians, of course, were – the Indians were mounted. So right away, Henry Atkinson, who was the theater commander – during the entire war, he had to rely on the Illinois militia, and he had to rely on them to not only call up men but to bring their horses. So right away, they were the main component of his army. He had, I think, a few hundred regular soldiers for the regular army, but they were all infantry and mounted on foot, so they moved very slowly.
Non-combatants, when did they start falling victim to this conflict?
Well, again, almost immediately. First of all, the Indians had, you know, Black Hawk had about 1,000 people. 400 were warriors, but the other 600 were women, children, and elderly. So his people were, you know, and again, militiamen. Traditionally, by that time, you know, armies differentiated between combatants and non-combatants, except when you were fighting Indians. And militiamen were horribly, horribly disciplined. They hated Indians. And to them, you know, killing women and children was, as long as they were Indians, it was okay. But Black Hawk's people attacked civilians too. I mean, they hit white settlements and they shot and killed who was ever there, you know, civilian or not civilian.
And from the white point of view, how were they justifying or promoting what was happening at this point? Were they seeing it as an important stand that would make a representation to the rest of the country as to what to do?
Well, I think there was a common set of ideas among whites about how to deal with Indians. First of all, the United States did not like fighting Indian wars because it was expensive. And they were a lot of small government people in government back then, more so than we have today. So they didn't want to fight expensive Indian wars. But if Indians were going to fight, the common idea, particularly among Washington lawmakers, military commanders, and just the U.S. population at large, was if an Indian tribe becomes recalcitrant and does not do what we want them to do and spills American blood, the only thing we can do is to basically defeat them and go at them with extreme vengeance, killing everything, everybody, if for no other reason to be an example to other Indian tribes that this could happen to you. So when, you know, when the army and the militia fought against any group of Indians, it was the idea that we have to destroy them utterly. We have to kill as many of them as we can, if for no other reason that we want this to be an example that will, you know, be etched in the minds of other tribes.
So what's the next conflict then after the one in which the 12 white soldiers are killed and three?
Well, then what Black Hawk does is he flees up to Lake Koshkonong, which is right near Fort Atkinson. And there's a lot of swampland there. And this is a good place to hide out. Plus, it was virtually unknown to whites. The only people who had been through there were mostly French fur traders and, of course, Indians. So he hides out in these swampy area around Lake Koshkonong. And he has a respite there because the first militia army that was formed, they basically say, we quit. After Stillman's Run, they began to desert and go home, and they were all just discharged after a month of service. So Henry Atkinson has to raise another militia army. That's going to take the better part of a month. And so he's, you know, Black Hawk has a month to sort of plot his next strategy. What happens there is small war parties of Black Hawk's tribe and also tribes that were sympathetic, like the Potawatomis and Winnebagoes, they begin to send out small war parties to attack scattered white settlements in northern Illinois and in southern Wisconsin, particularly in the lead mining region.
So, is this a war, though? Is it a one retreat after another? I mean, is it really just a big retreat on Black Hawk's part? Because he's going constantly north and west.
Well, his plan after the Battle of Stillman's Run, he says, I got to get back across the Mississippi, if for no other reason than, you know, to get away from all these white soldiers are sending against me. But, of course, he had to do it. He had to avoid his Indian enemies as well. The Menominees were still screaming for Sauk and Fox blood. They had an ongoing war with them for a while. And the Menominees were allied with the Sioux Indians who lived in Minnesota. And the Sioux also fought the Sauk and Fox. So he's in friendly country among the Winnebagoes. But at the same time, if he's going to go back across the Mississippi, he has to avoid the Menominees. He's got to avoid the Sioux. He also has to avoid whites who have been sent against him. So it was a tricky set of moves. But anyway, for about a month after Stillman's Run, it's a lot of small-scale skirmishes and raids by the Indians while the White Army was getting set up again. And really during that whole month, the only person who really has any luck in defeating these war parties is Henry Dodge of the lead mining area. Later becomes governor of Wisconsin because he was a pretty charismatic figure himself. He put together a small army of lead miners, and he led them in the Battle of Pecatonica. But mostly it was the Black Hawk held the initiative. Now, once Atkinson forms his new army, then it's a full-fledged retreat. Black Hawk flees west. He goes through what is today Madison. He fights a delaying action near what is today Prairie du Sac, which was probably the high point of the war for him. It was very successful. But then when he gets to the Mississippi, you know, his people are starving. They're, you know, many of them have been killed.
That's a much more difficult river to cross than the Wisconsin.
Yes, it sure is. And he didn't have canoes or anything because they had abandoned what canoes they had at Lake Koshkonong. And there it just becomes a total massacre known as the Battle of Bad Axe.
And it even brings in a steamboat at one point. I mean, the Indians maybe have a little glimmer of hope to get across, but suddenly there's this steamboat that shows up.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the steamboat kind of showed up toward the end, the Warrior. But yeah, it had been used to ferry troops up from Baton Rouge in Louisiana, a bunch of regular troops to send them to Prairie du Chien in Fort Crawford. And once it got there, the garrison commander at Fort Crawford said, hey, we could really use this, your steamboat. And they mounted an artillery piece on the front. They had some volunteer militia go on board of it, and they showed up at the Battle of Bad Axe. By that time, Black Hawk's people were squished between the White Army of Atkinson on one side, this steamboat in the river that was shooting at anybody who tried crossing the river. And it really was a massacre. Several hundred of his followers died that day.
What are the procedures for surrender? I mean, it seems to be slightly different than when dealing whites on whites, where you invite the losing side to surrender and then you talk terms. It seems more like a peace conference in the American versus Indian confrontations. Is it quite the same?
Well, Black Hawk's chances to surrender were gone after Stillman's Run. I mean, Atkinson was not going to just let him say, okay, I quit. Let me just cross the Mississippi, go into Iowa and leave us alone. No, he had to be punished. This was sort of part of the white way of war. He had to be shown that what he did was a bad decision. And he wasn't even at the Battle of Bad Axe. And that was probably one of his less heroic moves that he had. But you know, they were not going to just let them surrender, especially warriors. I mean, because they were dangerous. Ultimately, when virtually no warriors are left, there was only a small number that got across the Mississippi, and they were just attacked by the Sioux. And until it was pretty much just women, children, and old people. A lot of them were killed as well during the Battle of Bad Axe. They didn't treat Indian surrender quite the same. And again, after the Battle of Stillman's Run, they weren't going to let them just off the hook and surrender and go back to Iowa.
Why was Black Hawk not killed?
Well, he made the case that he told his people we should head toward the Ojibwa country because the Ojibwas were allies of the Sox and Foxes. And basically he said, anyone who wants to follow me, I'm going to the Ojibwa country. Well, the vast majority of those who were left said, no, we want to cross the Mississippi and go back to Iowa. So he left with probably about 50 or 60 people. About 500 were left at the Mississippi. And he was heavily criticized among the survivors for that, just fleeing. They said, you should have stayed here and stayed with us. And I think it was rather a foolish move on his part. He did try to go back. He didn't even know the army was still following him. He was really sort of in the dark after the Battle of Wisconsin Heights. But ultimately, there were Winnebagoes up near what is today La Crosse and Toma, who, when they found him, there was a big reward out for him. And not all of the Winnebago bands were very closely allied with the Sox, especially the ones up near Toma and La Crosse. So they said, no, we're turning you in. And you were taking it down to Fort Crawford and Prairie du Chien, and we're turning you in for your reward. But, you know, once the Battle of Bad Axe was over and there were only scattered survivors left, then the U.S. decided to put an end to it all.
We're going to talk about the final years of Black Hawk's life and the legacy of the Black Hawk War when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Hi, this is Larry Mueller inviting you to join us Monday after 11 for advice on using your new digital camera with Jack Socha of Spring Grove, Minnesota. Then Jim LaLuzerne of DePere offers advice on choosing prescription eyeglasses. Join us Monday with your questions and comments on the Ideas Network.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Patrick Young, and we're talking about his book, The Black Hawk War of 1832. How do you justify calling it the Black Hawk War if, in fact, it's very little more than a massacre with revenge exacted on the Indians, even when they're trying to get away, even when it's down to just a few remaining people, they're getting killed and slaughtered? What makes it a war?
It was a massacre at the end, but I would say from the time of the Battle of Stillman's Run, which was in the middle of May of 1832, it had the aspects of a traditional Indian war and I guess a traditional Euro-American war. After the Battle of Stillman's Run, Black Hawk, who has got his people safely situated around Lake Koshkonong, he sends out a lot of war parties that attack white settlements. He particularly was interested in attacking settlements in northwestern Illinois and southeastern Wisconsin because he was hoping to draw Atkinson's army there. But Atkinson pretty much knew where he was, so he wasn't going to be fooled into going toward the Mississippi. And then once Atkinson moves up the Rock River toward Lake Koshkonong, Black Hawk flees westward. And again, the Battle of Wisconsin Heights, which was largely due to Henry Dodge, who had picked up his trail and was able to figure out that he was crossing the Wisconsin River, he engaged in a relatively traditional battle there. Black Hawk had about 120 warriors. He basically used them as a delaying force to stop about the 600 people under Dodge. And it was a relatively traditional battle there, too, of maneuver, of planned retreat and everything else. And it was all conducted by warriors as the, you know, non-combatants among Black Hawk's people were crossing the Wisconsin River. But after the Wisconsin River, everything begins to fall apart for him. His people are out of food. Many of the elderly and the very young members are starving to death. And they're basically forced to retreat from the Wisconsin River all the way to the Mississippi River. And Black Hawk doesn't think that Atkinson's following him. He figures after he's crossed the Wisconsin River, he's at least free of the army of Henry Atkinson. And, of course, he wasn't. Atkinson decided to follow. And Black Hawk got a little sloppy. He didn't post, you know, rear sentries. He didn't try to keep an eye on movements. He just assumed wrongly that the army wasn't going to follow him. And when he gets to the Mississippi, I think one of the reasons he wanted to flee to the Ojibwe country, he figured, well, if these 500 people don't want to flee to the Ojibwe country, well, fine. It's going to take them all across the Mississippi, but they shouldn't have any problem. And, of course, he didn't understand that Atkinson's army was only a day behind. And once he finds out about the fact that Atkinson's army did follow his people and that they are being engaged along the Mississippi at Bad Axe, he tries to get back to at least to fight. But it's already too late by the time he decides to do this for the most part. And it's a massacre. I mean, the white militia and the regular army just did not plan on sparing anybody. Women and children were killed. Warriors were certainly the primary target. As they were trying to swim across the Mississippi, they were being shot in the water. So it really was a massacre. It was just anything that moved was liable to be shot. Little children, old people, women, didn't matter. So the Battle of Bad Axe was the real massacre of the war.
Why didn't Black Hawk take his life rather than put up with being in captivity?
Well, that wasn't part of, you know, the warrior culture of American Indians. They didn't commit suicide. As a matter of fact, I'm trying to think now if I'd ever come across a case of it, but I haven't. I don't think there was any honor in killing yourself either. The honor came in being killed by your enemy. There was honor in being killed and being scalped by an enemy.
Now, the main power broker on the west side of the Mississippi at this point would have been Keokuk?
Yeah, Keokuk was the leader of the Flocks and Foxes who didn't follow Black Hawk, and they were pretty bitter rivals. Again, 1/6 of the Flocks and Foxes followed Black Hawk, 5/6 followed Keokuk. And Keokuk, he was hardly, at least at first, early in his career, he wasn't necessarily a lackey for the Americans. But he rightly said, hey, look, we are not going to win. We, you know, yes, we were swindled out of our land on the east side of the Mississippi, But what are we going to do? We cannot defeat the power of the United States. And he had been to Washington. He had seen the Eastern Seaboard. He understood how big America was. And he said, this is foolish. It's just, we are not going to accomplish anything. So he agreed to cross the Mississippi. And he would retain leadership till the day he died. As a matter of fact, he wasn't from a chiefly clan either. He was much like Black Hawk in that he had risen to the top surely through his personal charisma. He was a gifted orator, and that was something that was prized among Indian communities. But after the war, as a reward for doing what the U.S. wanted, the United States basically made him the prime leader, the chief of the Sox and Foxes, essentially by presidential fiat. I mean, he just said this. Jackson said, this man will lead the Sox and Foxes. And from there on, Keokuk kind of played that to the hilt. He controlled land sales, all the proceeds and all the annual amounts of money promised under treaties he controlled. And so just by control of the cash from land sales, he basically was, he was given power by the president and he was also given a lot of economic power.
Black Hawk couldn't stand that guy.
No, he couldn't. To the day he died, he said, Keokuk has been the source of all my problems. Although after he's defeated and he's back in Iowa, he basically says, I'm not going to challenge him anymore. I'm not going to say boo about land sales. And he realized the game was over and he didn't like Keokuk. But even Black Hawk, and he went east to meet Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson made him wear a white cotton shirt and a blue army frock coat. And he wore that to the day he died. He even began to drink brandy occasionally. He ate like a white person did at a table with utensils.
Went to theater.
Yeah, went to theater. He basically said, I've got to accept this. I led too many people to their ruin. I'm not going to be the source of any more trouble for my people.
And some of the illustrations that you include of him, that they're almost hard to look at because he's wearing costumes that are not his own. Mm-hmm. And there's his face. There's something in his eyes that's a little haunted looking. Can you talk about the last years of Black Hawk's life?
Well, first of all, I think every painting made of him was made during his captivity. I think there were more portraits painted of him than any other Indian. In 1833, he was taken on a spring and summer tour of the East Coast. And he saw Washington, Norfolk, Virginia, New York, and Philadelphia. There were newspaper columns devoted to what he was doing on the East Coast. Crowds of thousands came out to see him. And you have to understand, they weren't white frontiersmen. These were relatively sedentary, Americans who lived in cities and relatively refined. So he was a curiosity to people out east. And he was amazed by the crowds that came to see him and everything. But he gets back to Rock Island, which is right off of where Sauconcourt was. It's an island in the Mississippi. I think he got there exactly a year after the Battle of Bad Axe. And he promises not to make war again. He had promised Jackson he wouldn't make war again when he met him in Washington. And for the remainder of his life, again, he continued to wear that blue army frock coat and army trousers. And he lived a very quiet existence with his wife and his sons and his daughter. And he was very, very gracious to white settlers. He would invite them for dinner in his residence. And he said he would not make war anymore. So he really went out of his way to be gracious to white settlers who were moving into the area. He even addressed crowds at 4th of July festivities. So.
Was there a persistent policy on the part of the Americans after one of these wars not to execute the chiefs, but rather to use them for PR purposes?
Generally, yeah. The Black Hawk War was unusual in that there were like 77 people, white people, killed. Oftentimes when Indians were directly situated in a murder, they would be indicted and prosecuted. But Black Hawk, I don't know if he actually killed anybody during the war. Okay, he certainly was at battles, but he was the commander and everything else. I think the United States thought, well, if we execute him, he becomes a martyr. That might be a problem. It was a lot easier and a lot cheaper just to take him on the tour of the East Coast, let him see how big the U.S. was, and he was wowed by it, and just tell him, don't make war again, go back, listen to Keokuk, and he promised to do that. So I think the United States just didn't see him as a threat. His followers had all been killed and scattered, so the threat was really minimal, and I don't think executing him would have done anything.
I was wondering if you could read the last paragraph of your book about Black Hawk and
sure.
Tell us your final thoughts about him.
Although Black Hawk may not have succeeded in his quest to retain his beloved homeland in the Rock River Valley, he did not have to be ashamed about what he had attempted. He did not seek to make war when he crossed the Mississippi with his band. And once the fighting started, there was little he could have done to stop it. He had been forced to fight, and he did it well. This was particularly true of his greatest moment during the war, the Battle of Wisconsin Heights, where, with a mere 120 warriors, he held off a force several times larger long enough to allow the main body of his band to conduct a river crossing. After he returned from the East in 1833, Black Hawk recited in his autobiography to Antoine LeClaire, the government interpreter at Rock Island, and a young newspaper editor named John B. Patterson. He dedicated his autobiography to Henry Atkinson, his foe during the war, because of the kind treatment that Atkinson had extended to him during his confinement. In his dedication, Black Hawk warned Atkinson, "The path to glory is rough, and many gloomy hours obscure it. May the Great Spirit shed light on yours, and that you may never experience the humility that the power of the American government has reduced me to." Now, more than 170 years later, it appears in retrospect that Black Hawk spoke these words too soon. During his life, he successfully walked his own path to glory, and a very rough path it was.
Did he influence at all that last Indian War east of the Mississippi down in Florida when Osceola began the Second Seminole War?
I don't think he really influenced it, but one thing I think I made clear in my book, and Gregory Dowd, again, I have to thank him for this observation, the Seminoles in Florida were part of the same pan-Indian resistance movement that had really been manifest among Indians in the eastern half of the United States since the mid-1700s. So in many ways, Osceola, the great Seminole leader, without a doubt, picked up the torch after Black Hawk, and he was part of the same pan-Indian resistance. He had the same pan-Indian resistance ideology that had led to the Black Hawk War, the War of 1812, Tecumseh's Confederation.
Patrick Young has been our guest. Thanks for joining us for University of the Year.
Thank you very much.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next University of the Year.